Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Rational Face Podcast. I am Brian Dillman.
And I am Brian Kissel.
And Rational Face is a Mormon-based blog and podcast seeking to provide a safe, fair, and balanced space to discuss the complexities, difficulties, and beauty of our Mormon tradition.
In an entertaining and informal way, we are dedicated to exploring the vital, applicable, and expansive topics that we're all wrestling with as Mormons, while simultaneously keeping Mormonism weird.
Absolutely. Always keep it weird. So, Brian, you've been hiding out for the last 2 weeks from the podcast anyway. So
I have.
I'm glad you're back.
I am really glad to be back. Took a little vacation and from work and everything, and it's been great.
Good. Well, before we get started, I want to remind everyone about the Liahona Project. We're raising money to support a Liahona Children's Foundation stake, and I'll leave a link on the webpage so you can, if you've missed all the buzz that we're trying to generate about that, you can click through and see what this project is, and please join with us in donating to that cause. And now, for our show today, I interviewed Brent Metcalf, who has just started a new podcast about Mormon studies. And Brian, as I understand it, you have strong feelings about people that feel like there are too many podcasts out there.
Yeah,
you don't believe that's true. Right?
Anybody who knows me knows that's true, yeah.
All right, so Brian, tell us your opinion on podcasts. Oh. Mormon podcasts.
Yeah, I do have kind of strong opinions on it. Let me kind of tell you what I was writing about a little bit on Facebook. So lately I've been thinking a lot about Mormon studies and Mormon scholarship in general. And if you think about the quantity that has been written about Mormonism, it's incredible. It's seemingly endless. I have bookshelves full of materials that I have not been able to read all of the things, and I've read a lot, but there seems like there's a never-ending supply of different topics that have been explored, different perspectives and ways that people are looking at things, everything having to do with Mormonism. I mean, if you look at Richard Bushman, when he wrote his book about Joseph Smith, there were already like 14 other biographies about Joseph Smith. And the reason that Rough Stone Rolling was a valuable contribution to Mormon studies wasn't because there were it wasn't the first book about Joseph Smith. There were already lots of different conversations and books about him. It was because he was able to bring a particular perspective that was, I feel, extremely valuable. And I still think that there's much, much more that could be written about Joseph Smith. So I think it's fascinating and that there are so many different materials. And if you look at Mormonism in general, nobody would say, well, my bookshelf is full. I already have too many books. Nobody should write about Mormonism anymore, because there's so much more to be said, I think. So I hear that argument every time a new podcast is launched, that, oh, we already have enough Mormon podcasts. There isn't a need for any more. And to me, it's like, I think about when I started podcasting with Exploring Sainthood, I was talking to Micah and we were talking about all the awesome different podcasts that were out there at that time. And I was saying, well, I've never felt like there was a podcast speaking directly to me. And Micah said, well, that's the beauty about podcasting. You can share your own perspective. You can share your own opinion. And I still think that there's so much more. So I guess the reason that the argument that there are already too many Mormon podcasts out there, I think the reason that bothers me so much is because I think the opposite is true. I don't think that there's enough. Like, we've talked about it before, where I've kind of done some crude thinking about like the different Mormon podcasts that I'm aware of, and it's kind of like 80% are white males, you know, and then you have like 10% white females, and then the other 10% are people who aren't white. I think that there are obviously reasons for that, but I think that there is such a need for more diversity. There are so many different voices and perspectives that are valuable that I think that we could really benefit from. And then one last thing about all this, if you don't like a particular podcast or even just a particular topic, let's say you're looking through the Rational Faiths feed, you don't have to listen to every single thing. You listen to that which looks appealing to you. And hopefully we are getting feedback and learning and able to create content that really speaks to you, you know, but when you're listening to new podcasts, that's all you need to do. You don't need to listen to everything. But to me, there is a value for more.
Well, I think we've just demonstrated that this is your platform for your opinion right here, right now. You've just been given that opportunity. So I agree. I think having lots of podcasts, lots of books, I think it's good because it allows for lots of perspectives. And some of them do sound the same. You know, you have a lot where they'll discuss either news or a doctrine or a bit of history, and they'll have a couple people on, and depending on which podcast it is, they'll either be more critical or more apologetic or more faithful, or however you want to describe that. And so I like seeing stuff that's a little bit different, and I think Jared Anderson's podcast is very focused on scripture and especially Mormon interpretation of scripture and how you can actually teach Sunday school in a little bit more broad way. Lindsay Park has
Feminist Mormon Housewives.
Feminist Mormon Housewives, and especially the part that she does that's the Year of Polygamy is very focused and unique. And Brett Metcalf's podcast that he's just releasing right now is going to be unique as well. It's focused on key figures in Mormon studies. And throughout this interview that y'all are about to listen to, he talks about what his approach is for this podcast, what he envisions, what the type of people that he plans on having on as guests. And I think it's going to be great. I listened to his first episode that's been released, talking with Jan Shipps, who is a non-LDS scholar of the Mormon traditions, both the what she calls the Prairie Saints, which is the mm-hmm. Community of Christ, and the LDS Church, the Mountain Saints. And so I think this is a great addition to the pantheon of Mormon podcasts.
Absolutely. I'm so excited to see the different contributions that he's going to be able to bring and his unique perspective that I think is really valuable. That you guys mentioned in the interview, his long interview with John DeLynn. His story is fascinating, and I think he has a really unique perspective. So let's go ahead and dive into that interview.
All right. Well, we have Brett Metcalf on the podcast today. He's sort of a popular name in Mormon studies. And if you really want to get to know Brent's story, he got himself entwined in all sorts of crazy Mormon events over the last, well, I guess mostly in the 1980s, a little bit in the 1990s. And he has some interviews that John DeLynn recorded over at Mormon Stories, and he's got, I don't know, 5 or 6 hours telling his story, and it's a really fascinating one, so I'd encourage you to go over there. But instead of taking 5 and 6 hours to get to know Brent, I've formulated a quiz that will help us get to know him even better than 5 to 6 hours of interviews. So, Brent, are you ready for your quiz?
Yes, I am. And right. And I'm impressed, and I've got to say that the interviews that John did, I think that they're actually 10 hours.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Yeah. My reaction exactly. So
this quiz is definitely an abridgment of sorts.
Yes.
All right. So we can know your true character. First question.
Yes.
Bench press or bicep curls?
Both.
Both.
Yeah.
Okay. Squat or knee extension?
Both.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thomas Paine or C.S. Lewis?
Oh, Thomas Paine.
All right. Star Wars or Star Trek?
Oh, Star Trek.
All right. Mountains or beach?
Oh, that's a good one. I think I'll go with mountains.
You've got Gulf Shores right down the road.
Yeah, I know.
All right. Cortisol or IGF-1?
I don't know.
Oh, man, I thought with the body, the weightlifting stuff, you don't want cortisol. You want IGF-1.
Okay. All right, we'll go with that.
Then ancient scripture or the Council of 50 Minutes?
Oh, geez. Any text. So, yeah. I mean, that's a really difficult decision because I love texts, period. Whether they're modern, ancient, doesn't matter.
All right. Well, I think my quiz might have failed a little bit because you like to do both of a lot of
right.
You're not selective. You'll get into anything.
Yes.
Okay, well, the reason we have Brent on is he's got a new podcast. He's been a figure in Mormon studies, and he's got a new podcast where he's specifically talking to other key figures in Mormon studies today. So let's talk a little bit, Brent, about the podcast that you've got started and what we can expect from it. So are you planning on doing five-hour interviews in the manner of John DeLynn? Or tell us about your podcast and how it's different and what you think is going to happen there.
Well, in terms of the five-hour interviews, I certainly hope not. My intention right now is to try and come up with something that's a little bit more manageable in size. And so, for example, the first interview that I've already conducted is just over an hour long. I want to have these interviews packed with as much relevant information and scholarship on Mormonism as we can bring together in an hour's time period. I will certainly look forward to having guests back at future times where we can extend conversations. But I want to try and get this to focus on very specific issues and covered in a fairly short period of time. In fact, I should mention that the tagline to the podcast is Mormon scholarship for everyone. I mean, we've heard, you know, you'll hear different titles of books and so on, whether it's Mormonism for Dummies or Mormonism for Idiots or, you know, Five Views on the Atonement. That's a, you know, that type of series from Baker Publishing or Zondervan. And my goal for this is to try and envision a podcast that can literally benefit anyone who is interested in Mormon scholarship. And so whether you're a novice, you're new to the scene, or whether you're a seasoned scholar, you will find something of interest in these podcasts.
What is Mormon studies? To someone who's just heard the term, maybe they had a cousin that wrote a paper for BYU Studies or a Sunstone Symposium or an article for Dialogue, and they're just hearing about this. What is Mormon Studies?
Well, in my mind, it's the a very broad application of multiple disciplines being brought to bear on interpreting Mormonism, whether it's contemporary Mormonism, Mormons' history extending to its origins, but it's not a matter of just bringing together a group of historians. It's also gathering the opinions of sociologists, psychologists, philosophers, and bringing them together as a body and saying, what do you have to contribute to our understanding of Mormonism? And so it's a very, very broad field. I don't consider this to be something that should be seen as limited to just a historian or a scriptural exegete, for that matter. This is something that I see as open, again, to a very wide field of interpreters. And that's who I'm looking at to be potential guests for the podcast. And I think that there are so many voices that are out there that are just rich and full of insight into Mormonism's remarkable, you know, depth and breadth. And that's the intent, is to go and find those folks and bring them together and allow their voices to be heard. And again, I'm not so much interested in trying to, one, certainly I'm not interested in debating with folks about issues on a podcast like that. Secondly, I'm not interested in having folks come on and necessarily, you know, launch into a particular agenda on a given issue, but I want scholars to come on who have done unique and remarkable research into Mormonism and to share those insights. And that's the goal. That's the whole goal of the podcast, is to make that available.
Okay, so you've been in this world of Mormon studies, reading the early writings and that. When would you say, I mean, from the beginning people have been studying and been thinking about Mormonism, but when would you say Mormon studies really got started, in the sense that you've just described it, where people are looking at it from all sorts of angles?
Well, I think that, you know, it goes back, you know, certainly to the early 20th century and probably even a bit beyond that. And that's where you have people who, you know, again, irrespective of whether or not you think their interpretations have legitimacy, you do have folks who are coming on the scene, who are interpreting Mormonism from a variety of perspectives. You know, whether you're talking about the Egyptologist, the Reverend Spalding, brought together in 1912, to talk about the Book of Abraham and their conclusions on the funerary papyri that Joseph Smith had in his possession, or whether you're talking about Fawn Brody, who was interpreting Joseph Smith in terms of a psychobiography. All of these things have contributed. I think that now we are at a point where these things are reaching a remarkable crescendo, where now you've got people who are within the Mormon community as well as without the Mormon community, with a variety of specializations that have gone even broader than that, who are now bringing their talents to bear on interpreting Mormonism. And so really we're at an optimal time in getting people together to provide their insights.
You seem to see more and more of it in all directions, because in the beginning, as you were talking, I was thinking maybe James Talmadge would be one where he was thinking about the atonement or the apostasy, and he was using Protestant literature to build his thinking about a Mormon understanding of the apostasy or a Mormon understanding of the atonement, using that scholarship. So he was doing theology. Would you include that in Mormon studies? And the reason I brought that up is you go to Greg Coford books and you have all kinds of people doing that. It's not just general authorities like Bruce R. McConkie or someone like that.
Correct. I would consider a wide variety of folks who are bringing to bear issues on Mormon theology. I mean, one who immediately comes to mind, of course, is Adam Miller and the work that he's been doing on trying to understand some of the philosophical underpinnings of belief and versus unbelief. And I think that he has a great deal to offer. And I think that there are a number of folks in that arena who are worth, you know, giving attention to. James Faulkner is another one. I think he's got some valuable insights, again, that are worth giving our attention to. And so I absolutely think that people who are doing what we might call Mormon theology, even though I think a debate could be had over whether or not a Mormon theology actually exists, but that's a whole nother issue. I think that those folks are lending some important and valuable insights as well.
Yeah, so that's an example of one of theology, and I guess sociologists, the first one that I could think of would be Armin Moss.
Right.
And now we've got, is it Ryan Cragen?
Yeah.
And I don't know of any others. But that's an interesting another way to look at Mormonism and what it does, especially in the here and now, in over the next last few years and what's happening right now.
Yeah, and you know, I know that one young scholar who I hope continues to pursue Mormon studies, Brian Whitney, I hope he doesn't mind me mentioning his name, but he's one who has tried to look at it from the social sciences and social theory. And I think that there is a great deal of insight to be gleaned from that. I don't think that any field of analysis should be excluded. In fact, on the contrary, I think we should try and be as inclusive as possible. Not that we're all going to have a kumbaya moment or anything, but with the intention of trying to broaden the base and our knowledge base, and try and extrapolate as much information from that as we can. I mean, who would have thought 30 or 40 years ago that we would ever be talking about geneticists being involved in interpreting the Book of Mormon, right? I mean, that would have just been unheard of. I mean, the closest that we got to that were, you know, very basic understandings of things involving the, like, the so-called mongoloid spot at the base of the spine and so on, and or blood typing. And now it's gone so much further beyond that that I don't think we would have ever anticipated that. And I hope that in the coming years we see, you know, another outgrowth of new disciplines that emerge to help us to understand Mormonism even more than we do now.
Yeah, I think that's really a benefit to the faith as a whole, not just to the Mormon studies world, because it shapes it helps shape the theology, it helps shape the way we interact with the rest of the world, based in more than speculation.
I agree with that, and I just think that there is a benefit from having your eyes open to as many different ideas as you can, because
yes,
it does lend perspective, and that's sometimes what's lacking in a lot of younger Christian movements, whether you're a Seventh Day Adventist or whether you're, you know, Mormon, it doesn't matter. The fact is that with any religious movement, I think that there is a benefit from having as many eyes, and by that I mean multidisciplinary eyes, on a given topic as possible. In the end, you can do nothing but benefit from that.
So we've named a couple names of, figures in the past, And then a couple names of people that are doing exciting work right now. Who else would you say right now are key figures? Maybe we could make a top 10 list or something like that of key figures in Mormon studies in a couple different branches, whether it's history or social sciences or something else.
Well, I would put it in maybe we can create a few buckets for it, because what one thing, for example, in my initial interview for the podcast series, which is I had it with Jan Shipps, and she's working on a history of Mormonism from World War II to the present. But what she's including in that is also what has gone on with the Community of Christ, or the what was then, back in that day, the RLDS Church, and whom she refers to, and others as well, refer to them as the Prairie Saints, and then the LDS Church as the Mountain Saints. And so I think that that they're a group of the Prairie Saints who really deserve considerable attention. Ronald Romig comes to mind, a good friend and remarkable historian who's doing work. Mark Shearer, who is the historian for the Community of Christ, he is again doing some impressive work on the foundational era. And then there are others as well within the Mormon community who are doing remarkable work. And, I think of the up-and-coming scholars like Ben Park, those who are associated with the Joseph Smith Papers Project, like Robin Jensen, Mark Ashurst McGee. Then there are folks that are at BYU who are involved with the Maxwell Institute, Brian Haglund, and others who I think are, poised to have a remarkable impact on our understanding of Mormonism. And while those folks are primarily in the historical and exegetical realm, dealing with scripture and so on, I think that they will provide much of the foundational aspects that will allow other folks in other disciplines to add on top of that. And I think that to a certain level, coming into Mormon studies and beginning with a strong foundation in its history and theological development basically primes you to look at other multidisciplinary approaches and understand the value that they bring to understanding Mormonism.
No, so that's a good list of names and some people to be looking for. Some of them I know, we had mentioned Brian Whitney. He's got some years in school left, and some of the others that I've talked to on the podcast, Joseph Spencer is finishing his PhD right now, right. And Colby Townsend and some others. Yes. There's a lot that are either in graduate school or just about to go to graduate school, and so it seems like we have this whole team of Mormon studies folks that are late 20s, early 30s, that are going to be doing a lot of research over the next couple of years. So where do you see things when this group passes on through, and let's say 10 years from now, where do you see Mormon studies compared to where it is right now, where it is today?
I think it will be in a wonderful position, and the reason why I say that is because I'm extremely hopeful that a new generation of interpreters will, far surpass those of us who have come before and been, contemplating these things for years and decades. I am extremely hopeful that they will lay a new foundation for interpreting Mormonism. And two, I think, you know, one thing that I've always been concerned about when I attend various historical conferences or, you know, theological gatherings or whatever the case may be, is what I've referred to as the grain of the associations, and that is that you're seeing the,
a lot of white beards.
Oh my gosh! You know, everyone has white hair, and it's, or at least gray hair. So the idea of getting this fresh, young blood in there to provide insight, that's the ideal situation. You want to take it far beyond where we're at now. And so I have considerable hope and considerable confidence in these, you know, up and coming young interpreters who are already providing remarkable value to Mormon studies. I would include even non-Mormon interpreters such as Christopher Smith, who is also working on his PhD right now. All of these folks are going to be wonderful contributors moving forward. So I see nothing but optimism for the future. And I think the more that the LDS hierarchy and, you know, will pay attention to what they're doing, the better off they will be ultimately. I think the move with the new gospel topics has been an important, transparent move on their part that I think ultimately the benefits will outweigh any of the deleterious effects that it could potentially have. So I think that young scholars are in a prime position to make significant contributions to Mormon studies.
Yeah, so you mentioned the hierarchy of the church, because that's, Mormon studies sits outside of the church. I don't know about the Community of Christ, if they embrace it as more so, or you know, if it gets integrated into their lessons or not.
I would say that as a whole, they are more inclined to integrate it within their curriculum and so on. Yeah, I think that they're far more inclined to do that.
Yeah, so they were probably, as in this particular area of integrating more of the history that is being uncovered, they were at where the LDS church is. They were there 10, 15, 20 years ago, I imagine. And
yeah, at least, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, on almost every major issue, they have preceded the LDS church, whether it's ordaining all worthy males to the priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
They were ahead of the LDS church on that. Mm-hmm. They're already right. Ahead of the LDS church on ordaining women to the priesthood.
Mm-hmm.
And they've already been ahead for years now on allowing critical scholars, and by the term critical, I don't mean in the sense that in a pejorative or negative sense, but I'm talking about very analytical approaches to the scripture.
Yeah, using a critical method.
Correct. They have been, you know, Richard Howard put out his book on Restoration Scriptures, I believe in the early 60s. And that was a book that went through in detail talking about changes to the Book of Mormon text, changes to the Doctrine and Covenants and the Revelations and so on. And it's taken us so much longer. Even when Robert Woodford did his dissertation on the doctrine, changes in the Doctrine and Covenants, it was titled The Historical Development of the Doctrine and Covenants. But he told me years ago that he had wanted to title it The Textual Development of the Doctrine and Covenants, which is in fact what it is, right, in terms of analysis. And he was told he couldn't use that. And so something as simple as that, and then his dissertation wasn't really readily available for years and years, and now it's being sold by BYU Studies. You can actually get a DBT, right, or a CD, or whatever the medium is that they're using, where you can purchase his dissertation in electronic form. And so times have changed. It's just that the LDS Church as a whole, or the Mountain Saints, as Jan would call them, have been much slower to coming to the academic party. And so, you know, kind of here we are now in a high-tech age where information can be found out, you know, within a matter of seconds. And I think that the internet has somewhat revolutionized things for the Mormon Church as a whole. In fact, it's kind of interesting because in my conversation with Jan, one of the things that I mentioned to her, I said, I almost see this quiet reformation going on within the LDS Church. And it's not coming from like the ordained women group or from anyone else, from any of the historical groups or anything like that. It's coming from within, and I think you can see it in the form of these gospel topics, where you are seeing information and concepts discussed that I couldn't have imagined being discussed 20 or 30 years ago in such an open way. And so, it, you know, when people say, well, I can't believe that you're surprised by any of these things in these topics because they've been taught for so long. Yes, in some corners, you know, in back hallways and corridors of board houses, perhaps. But to even suggest that these are things that have been discussed widely over the pulpit, let alone ever in a general conference in recent times, that's being completely disingenuous and unfair to those members who are now finding out about a lot of these things. And so I think that the gospel topics are an important step forward, but they're kind of a baby step still. They're not nearly as huge of a leap as some people think. And that's because I think that some folks don't necessarily quite understand the nature of certain things when it comes, for example, to LDS scripture and the historicity of them. These are issues that are looming far larger than any of the gospel topics have even begun to treat.
Yeah, and that I think that's the thoughts that I've had and the questions that I have is how does a church that as large as the LDS Church is, the Mountain Saints, and one that's held to a simplified sacred narrative for so long, you know, it seems like how in the world do you go about shifting to one that would integrate ideas in Mormon studies and evidence from Mormon studies into their belief system or into the way they teach about their church and their gospel, their doctrines and things like that. Because, you know, there have been minor changes in like the seminary manual where they're talking about polygamy a little bit more. And have you seen the Mitt Romney? Apparently he gave a speech at BYU a day or two ago.
Which I actually thought was remarkably brilliant and dare I say even human of him.
I thought the
way he put it, his comedic timing was awesome.
Yeah, it was perfect because, like you were saying, the people that say, oh, we've known about this stuff forever.
Right.
He basically said the opposite of that. When I was here, Joseph Smith only had one wife.
Right.
So.
And there are things. Well, here is my thinking. So going back to your core question, and that is, how does the LDS Church, or any church for that matter, begin to integrate this? And I think it comes with a first step. And that first step is to trust in scholars that they have the intellectual capacity and integrity to try and understand scripture and history in the best way that they can, and that they don't have these ulterior motives to bring down the faith and bring down the church. So, as a case in point, I was excommunicated in 1994. My good friend David Wright was excommunicated in April of that year. I was excommunicated in December. David and I had both, been involved with the book New Approaches to the Book of Mormon. I was the editor of the volume as well as a contributor, and David was one of the contributors. He was a professor at BYU. And David went through a really awful experience, in my opinion, ranging from his termination at BYU all the way through to his excommunication. When he was terminated from BYU, he was told that he was being terminated because he questioned the historicity of the Book of Mormon. I actually saw the letter that was sent to him, and the letter specifically said that he was not being terminated because he was teaching these ideas, but because he held those ideas.
Because he believed wrong.
Correct. And as a result, David lost his job. And so his, his career opportunities became, everything was thrown into upheaval. He didn't know where he was going to go from there. As it turns out, he's ended up landing in a wonderful position, teaching at Brandeis University, and I believe teaches Hebrew Bible and Judaic Studies, Brandeis. He's been the chair of that department, and not long after he started working there, he was excommunicated. And so that's an example to me of what not to do, right? This is an example of looking at a scholar and assuming the worst. And the thing is, when they were making those assumptions about David early on, that's not at all where David was. He was somebody who had a desire to see what he referred to and actually published in Sunstone as a post-critical apologetic, an approach to Mormonism. And that is, if you're going to be apologetic at all about Mormon scripture, you should come at it from the perspective that you've already done the critical analyses. And that at that point, then you look at it and say, what is a telling that I can give of this that will help ameliorate certain concerns or issues that people may have toward their beliefs? And And unfortunately, he was let go from his BYU position and then eventually excommunicated, you know, just over 6 months before I was. And that is the way not to go about doing this if you want to see Mormonism become a vibrant, healthy faith for the future.
And it seems like his student, David Bakovoy, is doing just that.
Correct.
And not being excommunicated just yet.
Right. And what's more is also taking, I think, a very healthy approach to trying to understand scripture in a very difficult climate and context. And I think that he is going above and beyond the call of duty to try and retrieve some semblance of belief and to allow people to still hold on to belief, even if they come to certain critical conclusions about scripture. And again, going back again to the question, here is the bottom line, is that you need to allow people to not only experience and believe and understand scripture differently than the mainstream does, but not to relegate them to some marginalized strata of people who should not be listened to, or they are, you know, apostate. These are people who are not claiming to have had some incredible revelation or had Jesus appear to them to tell them what's going on. These are people who are simply trying to grapple with the intellectual data that has been given to them. And I think that that's a very different thing than having somebody stand up in church and say, you know, God appeared to me last week and told me that this is a bunch of nonsense and you need to start following me now. That's not what these folks are doing. They're trying to be intellectually honest. They're trying to grapple with their own consciences when it comes to this type of information. And I think to try and marginalize them is the worst thing that you can do moving forward, because the younger generation are going to be seeing and reading what these people are talking about. And I don't think that they're going to be such, I hate to say this, pushovers as previous generations have been, because the information is out there and it's too readily available, and you cannot stop the deluge of data that's coming in. It cannot be stopped.
And we're seeing that right now. I think you hear a lot of stories through John DeLynn and some others that show that this generation, the millennials, are a little different because they've grown up in an age where it's fine to question authorities. And so it seems to be the disposition of the millennials to question things and to think about things.
Right.
What's your take? I wonder about this. You know, to do Mormon studies, to do the things that you've done, takes a personality and an interest that is deep beyond the soundbite culture that seems to be so pervasive right now. Watching, you know, a 5-minute YouTube video is too long. I need something that's 2.5 minutes if I'm going to take the time to mm-hmm. do it. And, you know, I imagine some people don't listen to some of John's podcasts because they're too long. They want something that's more like 10 minutes or 15 minutes. Do you think that this new generation is going to be patient enough to do this sort of scholarship and wade in deep, or do you think maybe they'll be less interested?
Well, I think the new generation of scholars will have the patience. If, well, for one thing, they, they'll have tools available to them that, you know, those of us from my generation didn't have, and where we were actually reading through every single, you know, issue of the Times and Seasons and the Evening and the Morning Star. And now you can run massive searches on them. But here's the down, you know, the downside to that. And that is that a lot of the electronic and digital tools that are available are by no means perfect. And so as a result, in fact, I've caught more than one person doing this in a conversation that I've had with them online about, you know, a very important historical issue. And I've made a substantive point on a certain issue. And I know that they have gone out and basically Googled that and come back with an argument based on what they found, not realizing that the source that they're citing, in fact, is the exact opposite of what they're saying. And, you know, an example was an exchange I had with one LDS, I think he would even consider himself an apologist, where he cited something from Webster's 1828 dictionary. And I was making the argument that a certain phrase in the Book of Mormon has its roots in something that had been written by Shakespeare, but also had been paraphrased and transformed over time, over the decades, to where you have George Washington using it in one way and so on. And he quoted Webster's Dictionary from 1828, to show how the phrase appeared that wasn't from Shakespeare. Well, if he had actually gone and looked at the original of the 1828 dictionary instead of the online version, he would have seen that, in fact, what was being quoted was from Shakespeare. It's just that the digital version didn't mention that, right? Mm. And so I actually called him out on that and said, you know, people who feel like they have PhDs in Googleology, that's not going to get you anywhere, right? It's not going to replace real hardcore research. And even when you're looking at, I mean, I'll tell you right now, I would never, at this stage of things, cite a reference that I found in a digital source without looking up the original myself. I just would not do it, because I don't care whether it's a piece of punctuation that's missing, where a comma hasn't been, you know, read by the OCR software well enough. I just won't do that. And that's something that I think new up-and-coming researchers can't succumb to. They need to go out and look at these original sources, even if they're using these remarkable digital tools to locate the information. Use it to locate it. Don't use it to base your analyses on, and certainly don't use it to quote it. You know, go out, look at the original, and see if it, you know, agrees with what you're finding in the digital sources.
Yeah, I kind of had the same irritation in graduate school when I would read a paper, and this is chemistry, so it has nothing to do with biblical scholarship or Mormonism or anything. But you'd read a citation about either a really powerful, strong claim or a rejection of a claim or something like that, and you'd go to see what they cited, and you pull up that journal article, and they're just citing someone else that cited someone else, and it takes 10 articles before you get to the original 1906 Journal of American Chemistry Society or something like that to get to the original bit of information where they were making this claim. And then you find out, well, that's not nearly as strong as it was because they didn't have the technology that we have now. Their measurement, their detection limit was a lot higher than what we have now, or whatever reason
right.
that is, that
right.
it's not necessarily appropriate to make that strong of a claim based on that citation. And
right.
it just takes more work. It takes more reading. It takes getting to the original to gain confidence.
Well, I still remember an instance where I cited a source in another online discussion, and one of the folks that I was in the exchange with came back and said, you know, I went and looked at the original source, and it doesn't say that anywhere. And I just said, look, quit using, you know, your gospel library because it's misread the text. And if you go look at the original, it's there. Because in this particular case, I knew exactly what the person was looking at. And that was leading them to actually accuse me of that the source didn't even exist. And I think that that's where it gets to almost comical proportions, right? It's like, give that up, you know, actually spend some time with the sources because they can be remarkable and enlightening. And they do take incredible patience, especially when you're dealing with the manuscript evidence and you're looking at all of the redactions that have occurred. You're looking at erasures that have occurred, you know, words that have been, you know, canceled by either wiping out. That's a technique that they used in the early 19th century where they would either, you know, when the ink was still wet, or they would wet their thumb and wipe through the ink, and it leaves a smear mark. But sometimes those words can be recovered. And with digital software that we have now, it makes it even easier to recover words like that. Well, that's the type of minutia that a lot of researchers seem to almost balk at. Whereas I find that to be the most fascinating stuff. That's the stuff I want, right? And so it's like we've got all these tools at our disposal, and we should be using them to dig through these sources to find out as much information as we can. But the use of, I'd put it this way, I guess. I hope that the rise and refinement of digital tools doesn't lead to intellectual laziness, because that would just be a crime, in my opinion. In fact, I think the opposite should be the case, where our intellectual curiosity is what allows us to make the most of these tools. These tools should be the things that they're tools in our hand. They should be the things that we use to accomplish what we need to, rather than assuming that they're going to do the work for us, right? So that's my take anyway.
Yeah, I would agree. I think I've had conversations like this about chemistry stuff and the analytical techniques and even simple things like Excel that wasn't there 30, 40 years ago, it changed the way you can process data.
Absolutely.
And so a lot of the concerns we would talk about using these tools, a lot of the concern is that you wouldn't know things as well because you're not intimately involved with it. But in fact, you can know things even better because you can get go through the data faster and you can get more information out of it. And it really comes down to, like you said, the curiosity of the researcher or the investigator looking into something. And if they're looking for an answer that they can find quickly, then they will find it and they'll probably stop right there. But if they're a intellectually curious person, they'll probably just keep on looking deeper and deeper.
Absolutely. And the funny thing too, is that there are still things that you would consider lo-fi or old school techniques of arriving at conclusions and coming up with interesting perspectives that are still readily available. I know that when Aaron and I in the John Whitmer Historical Association conference before this last one, we presented a paper on the so-called Whitmer Anthem transcript. And, you know, I don't know if a lot of your listeners are aware, but that small piece of paper that shows the horizontal lines with the Book of Mormon characters and has the word characters misspelled above all of them, that was actually part of a much longer document. And we've got a photograph of it that may well date to the 1860s or thereabouts, that shows a portion of the rest of the document that includes some handwriting. And through a considerable amount of research, we came to a conclusion that actually differed from our friends and colleagues at the Joseph Smith Papers Project, who came to the conclusion that the handwriting was that of John Whitmer. We came to the conclusion that it's in fact the handwriting of his brother, Christian Whitmer, who we also identified as one of the unknown scribes to the Book of Mormon. But what's interesting is that with this document, when my wife brought home one night a photocopy of the document, and I was looking at it, and it was based on the photocopy that I first noticed this, is that there were some shadows on one side of the document, because the question was raised of which direction was the document folded, because it had clearly been folded into multiple parts, probably four initially. And I could see these gray shadows, and from that, we went through it, reconstructed what we thought the original document would have looked like, and then put these pinholes through it, and then took a yellow highlighter and marked over the top of them when the document was folded to see where these pinholes of these gray areas would match up to the top portion where the characters were on the document. And as it turns out, they matched up to portions of the characters, which told us that that was actually a chemical reaction between the ink on those characters and the page down below, and we could tell which direction the page was folded.
Oh, wow.
Now that's as old school as you can get, right?
Yeah. That's like Sherlock Holmes.
Right. And then what's you know, again, going to the high-tech side of it now, on one of the documents that we were looking at that has both Christian Whitmer's handwriting and John Whitmer's handwriting on it, writing out the exact same lines. And these lines that are on there are portions of the line that appear on the lower portion of this Christian or of this Whitmer Anton transcript. And so, by the way, if you hear me pronouncing it Anton, it's because that's actually how his name was pronounced. It wasn't Anton, right?
Okay.
It was Anton. So anyway, yeah. So on this document, which is, that's the only two lines that are on this page. And this is in the possession of the Community of Christ. And I sat there looking at it one night on my laptop, and I thought, I'm looking at it and I'm going, I swear, I am seeing, my eyes are either going crazy or I'm seeing shadows that are occurring going across this page in these incremental patterns over and over again. So I went through and ran a bunch of digital enhancements on it and then flipped the page, right, so that it was facing the opposite way, as if it were, if you took that page and had it lying against another page that was facing it. I flipped the image and found out that the text, this is actual text that's on it, and the ink is burned onto the page, and it's a missing copy of DNC 38. And it's and we could even identify the handwriting, that it was in the handwriting of John Whitmer. But this is a copy of this revelation mm-hmm. that we don't have. Right? The community of Christ doesn't have it. We have no idea where this document is. And yet it's left its imprint right on this page. And so that was one of the things that we presented. I went through and showed everyone. I said, look, here, you can read the text. And it was through doing these digital enhancements that if we had not had that available, we may never have been able to recover it. So that's an example, I guess, of what I'm trying to get to here, of going very old school and finding something that's really quite remarkable in a lo-fi way, and then turning it up hi-fi with real digital content and finding something that we may not have been able to find out, if we did not have these digital tools.
Yeah, and the only way you would have gone that far is the fact that you're a document nerd.
Yeah, which is, I guess that could be almost a pejorative in some context, but I take it as an absolute compliment. Because,
well, that's how I mean it.
Yeah, sure. That's the stuff I get into, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I look at these documents, and I almost have this inner dialogue every time I look at a new document like this, and it's basically, what stories do you have to tell me? That's what I want to find out. It's not what stories do I have to tell you, right? Mm-hmm. It's, okay, you tell me the story. What's going on here? And that's what I'm looking for. And, as a result, we've discovered some remarkable things and very exciting things. So, and it goes on. It hasn't ended.
It sounds like fun. It's fun hearing you get excited and talk about the process of finding this new understanding of a document, or finding information that wasn't apparent.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a lot of fun, and I look forward to hearing stuff like this, hearing other scholars get excited about what they're into, what they're studying on your podcast. Why don't you share with us, if you want to say what the website name is and where it's going to be, where it is or where it's going to be coming from.
Yeah, absolutely. The podcast will be available shortly at, it's MormonStudiesPodcast.com. It's about as easy to remember as it can be. And it will be available on iTunes. And by the time you're hearing this, chances are the site will be live, and the initial podcast will be available. There's also the intention that I have, anyway, is to also include occasional bonus material that you won't be finding elsewhere or will be difficult to find elsewhere, and that will go beyond the podcasts themselves, but also include digital copies of documents from time to time that people may not be aware of. So I think it's going to be an excellent site and a great resource for both scholars and neophytes alike.
Oh, well, that is cool stuff. I look forward to that. Thanks, Brent, for coming on the podcast. This is a lot of fun. It'll be interesting to see where things go with the scholars that you talk with, and especially if we could pull out our crystal ball or our seer stone, I suppose, and see where this world goes in another 10 or 20 years.
Agreed. And thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it. And I appreciate you indulging my document nerdiness.
I've loved it.
All right. Well, that was such a wonderful conversation. I'm so excited about his project. I did want to ask you, what's up with you calling everybody nerds? You're like the bully of online internet Mormonism.
You said everyone gets a voice, so
yeah.
I'm going to be the bully.
Even bullies
make fun of
have
people
a voice.
If they're nerds.
That's the beauty of podcasting.
Yeah. Hey, I'm a fledgling Mormon studies nerd. I'm just getting into it, so I guess it's my way of saying I think they're cool. Because I studied polymers for 5 years, and that's pretty nerdy.
Right,
I studied coatings and glue for 5 years. So
yeah, you did chemistry. Come on.
Yeah. So that was fun talking with Brent. He's really into this stuff, and I think he's good because he's been around for a while and he's seen all the different figures. He's going to have a really neat perspective on different than a lot of other podcasters, I think, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I really do think that this is a niche that has not been tapped into as much as it can be. Like the serious Mormon studies aspects. I mean, there are lots of stories and lots of explorations of those different things. And I see a lot of most of the Mormon podcasts as kind of being directed towards us, you know, people like us who are not really experts, but we're fascinated by these things. And it'll be interesting to be able to dive deeper into specifically Mormon studies. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, so that's great. And this next week, what you can look forward to is Brian and I will be interviewing Bob Reese, who is one of the founders of the Liahona Children's Foundation. So we'll learn how that was founded, why it was founded, and how the Liahona Children's Foundation works in conjunction with the church, how it actually delivers the needed goods to the children who need it. You can look forward to that.
Absolutely. I think I've said this before on this podcast, but Bob Reese is one of my heroes, one of my favorite Mormons in the area of Mormon studies. And I think he works on projects that have such value and importance. And this one in general, I'm so excited that Rational Faiths is really getting into this and trying to contribute, because I think it's such a vital and important cause that we should be concerned about.
I agree. I'm looking forward to interviewing him and getting the interview out there for everyone else to learn more about this project. And so with that, we'll close. And listeners, if you like what you're hearing, remember to go on to iTunes, give us a rating, leave a comment on what you think of the podcast, share it with your friends.
Absolutely. Please tell your friends and do that. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you in the next episode.
We'll see ya.